Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2005. This is flight number 245, and I'm your pilot, Fred Vobey, and my address is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. If you live in the United States of America or Canada and would like to become a member of the DX Audio Service, the cost of a subscription is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Those prices are also the renewal rates. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. If you'd like to subscribe, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or just simply log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and look for the Join Us link at the top right side of the page, and you can sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Before we get into Bill Hale's column, I just want to mention some of the new phone numbers one more time and urge you to make that change. These are the telephone numbers that National Radio Club members can use to contact me or to leave a musings to the members. Ready? Okay, let's copy these down. The new DX Audio Service number is 360-382-1957. That's 360-382-1957. If you're calling just to muse, call 360-469-0189. That's 360-469-0189. I have turned off the old musings number of 419-224-1609, so if you call that old number, all you'll get is a phone ringing in your ear and you will not be able to muse. Again, the new musings number is 360-469-0189. More details on side two of the tape, but right now we've got to land in Fort Worth, Texas and visit with Bill Hale.
Thank you, Fred, and welcome everyone to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for August 2005. First of all, call letter changes on 710 WQKI, St. Matthew, South Carolina has chosen WPOG for their new call. On 740 WGSM in Huntington, New York has chosen WNYH. On 790 KOOR in Clovis, California will be KFPT as they switch to a talk format. 970 WRKN in Brandon, Mississippi will take the new calls of WZQK. On 1210 in Auburn Federal Way, Washington, KDDS is now KWMG. On 1230, WLFH in Little Falls, New York has chosen WIXT for their new call. 1260 KSUR, Beverly Hills, California, their new call, KKGO. On 1430, WRTH in St. Louis has taken the old call, WIL, as they return with a switch to classic country from Music of Your Life format. And 1490, KVAC in Forks, Washington, their new call, KBIS. Now, a couple of those calls from St. Matthews, South Carolina, Huntington, New York, and Brandon, Mississippi, all hedge on a sale of the station, so they may not be in effect immediately. Moving on to CPs on the air, 750 KHWG in Fallon, Nevada is now on with 7,500 watts during the day, 250 watts at night, and 7,500 watts during critical hours using three different patterns. On 1030, WEBS in Calhoun, Georgia is now on with U4, 5,000 daytime, and 3 watts at night. 1240 WOBT, Rhinelander, Wisconsin, is now on with 950 watts during the day, 1,000 watts at night, U1, relocating the transmitter to a 400-foot tall tower with the bottom 200 feet being a folded unipole skirt. 1330 WEBY in Milton, Florida, is on with the daytime power upgrade and relocation of the transmitter. They are now U5, 25,000 watts during the day and 79 watts at night, using three inline towers during the day, and the 79 nighttime watts from their original site. The bulk of the day pattern goes due west. 1340 KSGT Jackson, Wyoming is now on from a new transmitter site. They remain U1, 1000, 1000. 1390 KFFK in Rogers, Arkansas is now on with 5,000 watts during the day, 30 watts at night from a new tower. 1410 KHCH Huntsville, Texas is now here. They moved up from 1400. They now have 250 watts during the day, 7 watts at night from a new transmitter site. 1540 WBIN Benton, Tennessee, their CP for U1 1004 That's 1,000 during the day and 4 watts at night. With a critical hour's power of 500 watts is on the air, increasing their night power by 2 whole watts. Every facility change reported here is significant. 1620 WNRP, Gulf Breeze, Florida. Their CP for U1, 10,000 during the day, 1,000 watts at night is on with a country format. Originally, if you'll remember way back when, the station was allocated to Atmore, Alabama, but after a series of applications and amendments, it has landed here in Gulf Breeze. The transmitter and tower are in Pensacola. Grants to existing facilities over the past month, 1180 WXLA, Diamonddale, Michigan, has been granted a CP to increase their daytime power and add critical hours operation. When built, WXLA will be D4, 10,000 watts daytime and 2,000 watts during critical hours. That D4 is two different patterns. 1270 KEPS, Eagle Pass, Texas, their CP is to increase the tower to 280 feet to accommodate their FM station, KINL. This will necessitate a slight decrease in daytime power, but they're now authorized to add nighttime service. When operational, KEPS will become U1, 890 watts during the day and 30 watts at night. 1680 WTTM in Lindenwold, New Jersey has been granted a CP for U1, 10,000 watts during the day, 1,000 watts at night, from a already standing tower in Camden, New Jersey. Some Canadian news to report, a new AM station to report in Canada, reversing the trend of late. The CBC has applied to add a new medium wave service at Tuktoyaktuk, Northwest Territories. The new station on 1150 with U1 40 watts day and night will rebroadcast the programming of CHAK 860 Inuvik, Northwest Territories. On the other side of the ledger, the CRTC has canceled the license of CFPS 1490 Port Elgin, Ontario, as the FM station serving the Port Elgin area, CFPS FM, has begun broadcasting. So we gain one and lose one in Canada. Well, a little bit of Mexican news. XERF 1570 in Ciudad Acuña has recently installed a new 100,000-watt transmitter. Although not up to the 50s and 60s power level of 2.5 times that, it is a significant increase over what had been churning out the past 15 or 20 years. So if you've noticed XERF sounding a little better lately, that is the reason. Well, fines everywhere are fine. KCHK 1350, New Prague, Minnesota, has been issued a $4,000 fine for failing to reduce power at local sunset. The FCC contends that KCHK did not reduce its power from 500 to 70 watts on 4 specific nights it was being monitored by agents from the St. Paul field office. And WLXE 1600, Rockville, Georgia, has been assessed a fine of $10,000 for tower lighting and painting violations in addition to WBKZ 880 in Jefferson, Georgia, was fined $3,000 for those same deficiencies. I can almost hear the Charlie Daniels band playing. The FCC agents went down to Georgia. Reported to be silent, WCTN 950 Potomac, Maryland, WCHQ 960 Quebradillas, Puerto Rico, WCST 1010 Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, KTOZ 1060 Springfield, Missouri, KRSN 1490 Los Alamos, New Mexico, and KLFJ 1550 in Springfield, Missouri. That's two Springfield AMers that are now off. By the way, that Los Alamos station, KRSN 1490, is reported to have run into financial problems and probably will turn in their license. WGRP 940 Greenville, Pennsylvania, and WCBG 1380 Waynesboro, Pennsylvania remain off the air, as WHGT 1590 Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and they'll likely stay so forever as the studio and transmitter building, along with their 4 towers, are down. It is speculated that the owner will turn in the license on that station. Well, a better note, WBTE 990 Windsor, North Carolina, has returned to the air. Well, that's my time. I want to thank Sean Axelrod, Jerry Conkling, Wayne Heinen, and Jerry Starr for info this month, and I thank you for listening. Well, John Balker has some really great IDs lined up for us this month, so let's travel now to Florida and check in with John.
National Radio Club.
Well, thanks once again, Bill Hale. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Travelogue. And now that you've heard all the future changes that are coming up from Bill, we're going to take a little step back and hear how some of these stations sounded over the last 10, 15, even 30 years in some cases. Today we're going to be starting the 930 kilohertz dial position, and we have over 60 station breaks to bring you. Some of them from the same station, but we'll get to that in a minute. I don't want to overlook John Sampson's contribution to the travelogue. John, how do you do, sir? John sent in a remarkably good tape this last month, and I really appreciate it, John. We've added it to the travelogue. And Ernie Wasilowski took a trip to Nova Scotia with his recorders running. And Ernie, hats off to you, Squire. Thanks very much, as always. 930 kilohertz, another regional channel, and we're going to start this travelogue in one of my favorite towns in the whole world. My mother grew up in Rochester, New Hampshire. We're going to go back 30 years as we start the August 2005 DX Audio Service travelogue.
The Browns have stopped the Patriots. Paul Harrison hit them. So goes that effort. 1:43 left. Let's pause for station identification. This is the New England Patriots Football Network.
You're listening to New England Patriots Football on 930. Real Country, WWNH, Rochester, Dover, Portsmouth.
And we revisited Rochester in 1989.
Rochester. Original hits from the New Hampshire coast on KOST AM 930.
CBS News, this is Frank Settapani. The government is blasting away at the gun that's been called the weapon of choice.
And I was glad we had recorded that station break because 2 years later in 1991, we were there once again, and this is what we heard.
Because a lot can happen in a little while. Lock it on All News 930 and listen 2, 3, 4 times a day. WZNN Rochester, Dover, Portsmouth. News when you want it. It's 4 o'clock.
In headline news, I'm Judy Fortin. Iraq tried again today to defuse a confrontation with the United Nations.
Now, for an independent station operating on the CNN radio network, those call letters, WZNN, made a very good choice, I think. But doggone it, the news format actually took hold in Rochester, New Hampshire, and the people in Manchester couldn't stand it. So this is what it developed into. Listen.
Only on News Radio.
News Radio. Worldwide.
WGIN Rochester, WGIP Exeter, and WTSL Hanover, Lebanon.
Now you know.
CNN Radio News, I'm David Hull. United States and Saudi Arabia launch another offensive to cut off support for terrorist organizations.
Well, I guess that's as much as I can stretch out of Rochester, New Hampshire at this time. Let's move over to Western Massachusetts.
This is your favorite radio address. In Holyoke, this is radio station WREB 930 on your radio dial.
And that's all we have of WREB, actually. 500 watts on the Mutual Broadcasting System. Remember them? But I also remember WREB because they were part of the Yankee Network. News, while it is new, the Yankee Network News Service on the air. Remember those? Oh, boy. Well, next we're going to skip across the Hudson River and go to the far westernmost point of New York State.
News with Mark Leitner and Ed Little from Western New York's number one radio station. WBEN Buffalo. Democrat Paul Simon got what he needed.
Well, let's come back a little ways east along the Erie Canal to the town of Johnstown, New York. And this would be in 1982.
Versions of a story involving U.S. forces in the Gulf. I'm Mike Allen on the Satellite News Network.
And now as we come south into New Jersey, we're going to hear an interesting two-part parlay here. I pulled over to the side of the Garden State Parkway in 1990 to make this first recorded ID. I lifted the hood so the police would think I was having some kind of trouble. And the second one you'll hear was the same exact spot recorded in the year 2000.
Off we go into the 6 o'clock hour on a Sunday. On WPAT, AM and FM Patterson, a Park Communication station, first in beautiful music for the greater New York area. I'm Jan Oakes, and coming up, Sergio Mendez with a one-note samba and the Spanish Flea.
This is Multicultural Radio Broadcasting's WPAT Patterson,
AM 930 in New York City.
El siguiente programa es patrocinado por sus productores, personajes y patrocinadores.
Yes, I would say that's rather multicultural. Well, what do you say we take another trip back in time? Another 30 years ago this month, this is August, and 30 years ago this month, Linda and I were in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. That's sort of in the eastern middle part of the Commonwealth.
News on the half hour. This is WCNR 930 First in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. This is the Columbia Montour Broadcasting Company.
Now, back not so long ago, there were two radio stations in Bloomsburg, one at 550 on the dial, actually it had been at 690, and this one at 930. But the one at 690 that moved to 550 had taken on the call sign WHLM in honor of its owner. Harry L. McGee, his name was. But Harry had always preferred the 930 dial position, so he bought WCNR at 930 and changed it to WHLM.
One down. For station identification here on the Phil's Radio Network.
The Philadelphia Phillies on the new 930 WHLM, Bloomsburg.
And now Jose Vedro, the batter for Montreal.
Well, now it's time to swing more seriously to the south. We'll go down into Delaware for just a moment.
WAFL-AM, Milford.
Well, actually, that was just barely a moment, wasn't it? But you know, that station, WAFL, at 930 in Milford, was only on the air for about a year in Milford. Then it became the FM side of this next call sign.
10 seconds for station identification.
WYUS, Milford, Delaware.
Back at Charlotte, North Carolina, picking up on the leader, Darrell Waltrip.
And while we're down that way, we can go just a few miles west of our nation's capital for this 5,000-watt news, talk, and sports station.
All right, the pitcher change necessitated by the pinch hitter Ernie Camacho on the mound. Right now, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves on the CBS radio network.
This is 930 AM stereo, WFMD, in Frederick, Maryland, 93 degrees at a half a minute before 6 o'clock.
Solikas has lifted. He's making his ninth start.
Last time we were in Frederick, there was a rather interesting experimental station on the air there, too. We'll have to get around to that one of these days. Well, we'll continue our travel log by going into Virginia, down Dave Marthouse's way, in fact.
You're in tune with the Business Radio Network at AM 930. WLLL Lynchburg is information and entertainment.
Welcome back to more of America's Dining and Travel Guide.
Oh, and speaking of Dave Marthouse, you know, he's going to be giving us a talk at the Culpsville Convention. Gosh, I hope you can make it. Dave's going to tell us all about operating a small station in a small town. And, you know, where the money comes from, I don't know. He and his partner have been known variously as Bonnie and Clyde, I'm told, by some close friends. But anyway, come and hear Dave at Culpsville. It's going to be Sunday afternoon that he clears up this entire matter. Now, it's kind of interesting there. WLLL runs just a single tower. That means they're non-directional. But then they're also, well, they have been, only a 5,000-watt daytimer at 930 on the dial. They now have a pre-sunrise authority coming up at 42 watts. I believe that's been approved. Anyway, that's what they've been talking about. But if you only go about 140 miles to the south and west a little bit, you come to Charlotte, North Carolina with a station at 930. Which we'll hear from next. It runs 5,000 watts days, 1,000 watts at night, but it is very directional, away from Lynchburg, as you might expect.
Please be sure to let us know what radio station you listen to when you get in touch with us.
We're here for your whole family. It's WYFQ, Charlotte.
Bible Broadcasting Network presents Daily Bible Reading.
You know, Charlotte's a real interesting community. Did you know at one time NBC was thinking of moving its news headquarters from Washington and New York to Charlotte, North Carolina? No kidding. Really true. So we're going to stay in North Carolina for this next station, but it's in the town of Washington, North Carolina. Now, that's on the Pamlico River, and that doesn't help a lot either, does it? But it flows directly into the Cape Hatteras Basin on the Atlantic coast. Washington, North Carolina.
When life hands you bologna, eat chocolate. I'm Lee Mirabal.
Full
Service Radio, WRRF, AM 930, Washington. From ABC News, I'm Gary Nahn. The president wants to put higher education within the reach of more students.
And way down in the southwest corner of Georgia is the city of Bainbridge.
WMGR, Bainbridge, with all this great music. Like this one here from Burton Cummings, and guess who? And these eyes at your home for unforgettable favorites.
Well, that'll put the lid on the travelogue for this month right here in southern Georgia. Well, that means we're going to start next month in the Sunshine State, and what could be nicer than that? Well, as a matter of fact, one thing that is very nice, and that's Mark Durenberger and this outstanding series he's putting together for the DX Audio Service. And you know, as I sit back and listen to what Mark's telling us, it's so reminiscent of a few of my years at NBC, in the radio division at least. And just the big bucks that are involved in planning facilities and staffing the place and programming. It's just enormous number of dollars. Well, enough from me. I'll see you next month. Here's Mark Durenberger.
You're right, John. Those wannabe superpower broadcasters had a terrific investment in their 50-kilowatt stations, and they were ready to expand their coverage by adding the extra power because all it would take would be more transmitter and tower. Some of them were applying for higher power because of the favorable signals they seemed to be getting from the FCC. And it wouldn't be the first time the commission sent them mixed signals about the Clear Channel matter, nor the last. But at this time, the FCC was trying to build a superpower arsenal, at least on paper, as it positioned the U.S. for the North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement of 1941, the famous NARBA. The goal of NARBA 1941 was radio standardization throughout the Western Hemisphere. The planning for the conference began in the mid-1930s. The superpower positioning took place against the noisy backdrop of powerful border blasters operating out of Mexico and interfering with some U.S. broadcast signals. The U.S. delegation wanted to reserve the ability to fight the border blasters with its own superpower arsenal if need be. But they also had to balance the interests of powerful Clear Channel broadcasters against Congress and the have-nots, who saw superpower in the hands of the few as further undue media concentration. The U.S. delegation went into the NARBA conference in 1941 with a list of 25 frequencies they wanted protected for single-station use, including possible superpower, and they listed 21 additional 50-kilowatt channels that could be duplicated. For the first time, the labels 1A and 1B were officially applied to U.S. authorizations. 1A channels were to continue operating non-directional. The 1B channels were to be occupied by two or more 50-kilowatt stations, usually employing directional antennas to protect each other. Interference from other countries would be accepted on the 1Bs, even within U.S. borders. Interference protection for the 1As was to be much more extensive, as we'll see. In the interests of protecting their own superpower stations, some member nations of NARBA pushed a curious turn of phrase into the final agreement. That verbiage would be cited in the ensuing Clear Channel discussions in this country. The NARBA language essentially stated that while 1B stations were given a maximum authorized power of 50 kilowatts, the 1As would be authorized a minimum power of 50 kilowatts. In this respect, the minimum vocabulary the U.S. endorsed as a signatory to NARBA would differ from the FCC's own 50-kilowatt maximum language. Something would have to give. In exchange for this subtlety, the United States gained a major concession from its neighbors. 1A co-channel stations in adjoining countries could be located no closer than 650 miles from that country's common boundary with the United States. By geographical happenstance, this language prohibited, with very few exceptions, any co-channel operation on U.S. 1A frequencies anywhere in North America. When the delegates returned home, the United States had its continued protection on the 25 1A channels. To answer the demand for more frequencies, the United States did agree to an expansion of the band to 1,600 kilocycles. What was not resolved at the 1941 NARBA was the U.S. position on superpower on the 1A channels. To implement the NARBA changes, the United States participated in a major frequency reshuffle. On March 29, 1941, many of this country's AM stations moved to a new dial location, where they've been ever since. Most stations moved up the band from 10 to 30 kilocycles, but few did much to their transmitter plants other than retuning and changing crystals. As a result, there exists today a number of stations whose towers are slightly longer than optimum for their current operating frequency. With the 1941 NARBA behind them, the FCC staffers could now turn to the issue of providing reliable nighttime service to the country's white areas. Attempts to build a record on the white area issue surfaced as early as an October 1936 FCC hearing. But it was on February 20, 1945, that the FCC officially opened Docket 6741, looking into the future of Clear Channel broadcasting. Thus began a struggle that was to last for 35 years and put a lot of consultants and attorneys' kids through college. As it opened the Clear Channel proceeding, the FCC requested industry input on coverage issues. Industry advisory engineering committees met at length and reported out several ideas. First, they suggested there was a need for at least four national nighttime services. The committees also agreed it was impractical to deliver four solid nighttime services across the country with only four stations on four channels, and they suggested that some form of duplication of channels would be needed. What was left to be resolved was how to get there. The advisors also ventured into economic matters, arguing that superpower operation, while seemingly successful in other countries where it was usually subsidized, might not do well under the economic model of U.S. broadcasting. It was suggested that the cost to cover wide areas of low population density might not be covered by the advertising dollars available in those areas. The report compared wide area nighttime skywave service to rural free delivery, RFD, in which mail costs are borne primarily by the urban centers, and the costs of serving remote constituents are essentially subsidized. The committees concluded that primary operating support for superpower stations would therefore have to come from urban centers, where the stations would presumably have to be located. Looking at a U.S. map and applying some logic, one could conclude there might not be enough large urban centers in the sparsely populated white areas to support superpower operation. Therefore, if cost support was to be a driver, relocating superpower stations away from urban centers would not be the best approach. That economic argument alone might have doomed the chances for superpower. For this reason and others, the FCC stayed focused on duplicating the 1A clears. The commission stated that the ultimate solution for white area coverage had to meet one primary criterion, maximum population gain. In fact, when later it began to authorize such duplicate assignments, we'll see that the FCC declined to name specific cities for their new signals, but instead identified only the states in which such secondary operation might be located on the 1A clears. So what was next? In the late 1940s and early 50s, proposals on how to deal with the clears appeared with regularity. It's interesting to watch the respective sides at play during this proceeding. There were those who honestly saw a strong need for new FCC service to white areas, while others were interested only in bringing about the dissolution of the 1As. Both groups had sympathetic ears at the FCC. Some of the public statements made by the commission during this period make fascinating reading as you watched the FCC slowly move toward the politically comfortable position that more stations are better for you. Our story will be served by my reading some notes from the official record as the Clear Channel docket was being assembled. First, in 1946, the FCC decided to allow daytime stations to operate on the 1As, but only inside a 750-mile radius from the 1A station. They reasoned that assignments outside that contour could preclude possible high-power operation or duplication on the channel. It's interesting that they picked 750 miles in light of what eventually happened. In granting daytimers authorization to operate on the clear channels, the FCC enabled a breed of political fighters who got a taste of their success and who would exert a sometimes ill-advised influence on the coming battles. Then in 1948, CBS proposed that FM stations be taken into account in defining white area service. CBS reminded the FCC that its own staff had reported that new FM assignments will provide service to 500 new communities in every state except Montana. The FCC wouldn't buy CBS's argument. They said clear channels would always be needed for wide area service under any foreseeable developments affecting the wider utilization of radio. Amazingly, it would be many years before the FCC would include FM in calculating radio coverage. During this proposal period, the FCC poked its toes into the water with a series of tentative ideas. In 1958, the commission suggested adding new stations in the western states, Class 1 stations on 660, 770, 880, 1100, and 1180. They also wanted new Class 2 assignments. Those would be those stations that had to protect the primary on 670, 720, 780, 890, 1020, 1120, and 1210 in areas where they were needed. Interesting language. The FCC made this proposal while at the same time suggesting it would leave the other 1A channels protected for higher power operation. In the light of all these trial balloons by the FCC, it's small wonder that industry watchers were becoming confused. This is Mark Dernberger, and we are reading a six-part series that I wrote and published in Radio World some years ago. We hope you're enjoying and following all of this detail, and we appreciate your requesting this information. Well, once passed the 1941 North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement, or NARBA, the FCC began to focus on ways to provide better nighttime radio coverage of underserved white areas. The choice, again, seemed simple but dramatic. Add duplicate stations on the AM clears, or authorize the existing 1A stations to operate with power in excess of 50 kilowatts in an attempt to provide solid service over wider areas. And ironically, the FCC still refused to include FM in its coverage calculations. Well, as this was going on, imagine the hullabaloo in Washington. In one ring, communications engineers and lobbyists asserting that additional stations on the clears would create interference that would destroy a national asset. On the other side, the folks who wanted an end to what they called the monopoly and unfair advantage held by clear channel broadcasters. In the middle were beleaguered commissioners who, in the view of many staffers, weren't tuned into the issues but were noted for being responsive to political pressure. Without the data needed to make a defensible decision, the FCC continued its trial balloon approach to resolving the clear channel matter. In 1958, the FCC proposed new Class 2 stations on 23 of the clear channels. 660 and 770 were already considered duplicated for purposes of this matter. At the same time they did that, they asked the 1A stations to make their case for superpower if it were authorized. Well, they responded. Among those responding was WCCO, which filed comments and a complete engineering exhibit in support of 750,000 watts directionalized west from Minneapolis on 830. They said this would provide significant white area coverage gain not available through the FCC's other proposed solutions. WCCO believed so strongly in the value and logic of its engineering data that it actually purchased land for a four-tower directional array to include a true Franklin antenna, and they began negotiating for the necessary usage permits and airspace. So how do all these different initiatives work themselves out? We'll find out next month as we begin the second half of the Clear Channel matter. This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Thanks so much for listening to this series. We'll be back again next month with part four. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Radio. Professional Radio Club.
This is Art Bell from Coast to Coast AM, and I'd like to congratulate the staff and editors of the National Radio Club for 20 years of providing the DX audio service to listeners of radio. Keep up the good work, and be sure and listen for W6OBB as you dial around the radio, usually about 3840 on 75 meters.
Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service, a nonprofit organization devoted to the radio listening hobby.
You know by now that WJMK Chicago and WCBS-FM in New York were replaced with the Jack FM format. And I have some comments to make on that particular item here. So, from Robert Feeder's column here on the previous Wednesday, which was June 29th, here's what he had to say. The man responsible for the blowing up the oldies format and replacing it with Jack FM has no apologies for any of the listeners who felt angered or betrayed. In fact, if he had to do it all over again, Chairman Joel Hollander, with Infinity Broadcasting, says Tuesday he'd do it exactly the same way. We love the people that listen to our radio stations, he said, but there weren't enough of them. Excuse me? The radio station was bleeding. I don't believe it. I stopped the bleeding. The only time will tell if we're right about it. We made a change, and I don't apologize for that. Although WJMK ranked 11th in the market, with a cumulative weekly audience of 722,200 when he pulled the plug on June 3rd, he says its aging listenership was eroding profitability. The Jack format, which he conceded was merely a new genre of oldies, is aimed at a younger demographic one. He says, my job as leading this company, for better or for worse, is to make every radio station as profitable as it can be. People want to put their blank, blank foot on your neck whenever you make a change. The problem is there's a lot of people who don't have the balls to make a change. Okay, we're on the offensive. We're not on the defense, okay? We might have made a mistake. Right now, I don't think we did. Even those who understand the business rationale for Infinity's decision to move its traditional oldies formats to the internet and replace them with Jack FM at WJMK and at WCBS FM New York still question the way Hollander made the move. By his own account, he made the decision over the Memorial Day weekend and handed down the edict to local managers the following Tuesday. In the case of Chicago, the only two people who knew were Senior Vice President Ron Zimmerman and Vice President GM Dave Robbins. Both were sworn to secrecy until Friday, when the change was done without warning at 4 p.m. Staffers who were blindsided by the move and prevented from saying goodbye on the air included Dick Biondi, the living legend and Radio Hall of Famer who launched the oldies format on WJMK in 1984. Loyal listeners were downright apoplectic. Hollander said, do you think I woke up in the morning and said, let me enrage the people of Chicago? Do you think that's what I'm about? If we could have done a different way, we would have, but we couldn't. The reason Hollander carried out what he called a stealth mission in Chicago and New York was fear that a competitor might preempt Infinity with a Jack FM clone. Who cares? Perhaps as Bonneville International down in San Francisco. Never mind that rumors of such a switch at Infinity's comedy talk WCKG-FM have been swirling around the market for weeks, or that three suburban outlets owned by Newsweb Corporation were already simulcasting the format as 9FM here. So whom did Hollander think would jump the gun? I have no idea and I don't care, he said. The potential existed that somebody else could have done it, whether it was Clear Channel or Bonneville, whoever might have been done. This is just the way we had to do it. It's unfortunate, but there's no good way to do something like this. Whether it's an addiction, whether it's a marriage, you're going to take a change. Make a change, you go and do it. You make your move, you may be taking a risk, but that's the best way to do it. Those who would accuse of Infinity of insensitivity towards its listeners and employees over the loss of a radio station or format they loved are guilty of, quote, mixing business and emotion, he said. Let me tell you about loss. You know what loss is? Loss is when you lose a child. Loss is when somebody's dying. I'm not trying to come across as cold and callous. I do as much for charity and as much for people as anybody in this industry. If you want to portray me as cold and calculating, that's fine. That's your prerogative. But you're doing a total misjustice because that's not who I am. And that's what he had to say. Now, some rebuttals from listeners. And I don't know how the listeners in New York feel about WCBS, but here's how the listeners in Chicagoland felt about this change. From one, for a guy who insists he made the right move by yanking the bleeding WJMK off the moves, Joel Hollander sure comes off as a defensive in your column. His tone, even as appear in print, is reflective of the megalomania which permeates corporate America, where every decision should be considered shrewd and outsiders have no right to question them. Next one. Thanks for putting a name and face to the train wreck at WJMK. I hope this whole thing backfires on them. Next, Hollander's attitude is exactly why I am an XM radio subscriber and iPod user. This is also why media consolidation is bad. When you let these big boys own hundreds of radio stations, they don't care about the local community. Next, that aging act listenership remark by the great Joel Hollander was about as insulting as it gets. He's the poster boy for why radio is so bad. What a corporate jerk. Next, please inform Mr. Hollander that neither you nor anyone else needs to portray him as cold and calculating person, as he so eloquently stated in your column. He seems to have done it on his own. Next, Joel Hollander is the epitome of everything that's wrong with radio. Instead of identifying what's wrong with individual markets, this pompous corporate clown makes sweeping changes that disposes of local personalities in favor of the latest radio fad. Jukeboxes saturated with Phil Collins music. Next, Mr. Hollander should learn the difference between having the balls to do something and having the brains to do something. Next. Wow, another articulate male executive on the offensive. At least he had the balls to say balls. You had the balls to print what he said, balls. Hollander appears to have been overly defensive because he knows what he did was terrible. He's basically a bully, making us out to be the bad guy just because we don't approve his actions. Next. I realize that radio is a business. What I also realize is that WJMK is now run by an uncaring, unfeeling person who doesn't care about his staff and cares less even about the listener. Next. If changing formats was an above board and legitimate business decision, he wouldn't have had to keep it a decision from his own staffers. Next. Not allowing Dick Biondi to sign off due to Infinity Broadcasting's paranoia that another station might preempt the new format is lame and disrespectful. Next. Where is the morality in silencing an on-air staff with no warning and replacing them with automation? With the impending threat of satellite radio, wouldn't you think that local icons like Dick Biondi, Greg Brown, and Fred Winston could be treasured? Next, we had every right to feel betrayed. Next, it's quite clear he's a bloviating first-class jerk. From Clark Weber, moral of the story is, if you're over 50, looking for entertainment and loyalty, forget Infinity and buy a dog. Next, emotion is what draws in listeners and keeps them loyal to a station. Next, ironic but perhaps Hollander's own emotion blinded him to his real mistake. Local radio is the business of emotion. You can't tell passionate people not to mix business with emotion when emotion is the primary component of the business in question. Perhaps Fred Bobby could identify with that in some way or relate to it. Next, the corporate world is not about sentiment or loyalties. Next, didn't we have another Joel here who thumbed his nose at the public trust? Joel Cheatwood, the ill-advised news executive at WMAQ Channel 5 who got run out of town by public outrage? Next, Hollander's universe is centered around New York without an understanding of any other market. These people know everything, and listeners are supposed to accept what tastes are dictated to us? Next, when did Gordon Gekko from Wall Street start running radio stations? Greed is good, Joel. Next, what planet is this guy from? Next, does he think he is God? Next, do you know you work for a newspaper and probably quote him in your column? Does his therapist know? And finally, sounds like someone's going to need a new publicist. Oh, did Hollander catch it by the fan? Wow. That's it for now, and I'll be back with football in just a moment.
It's time for a pattern change. Or at least to flip over your tape for more of the DX audio service.